In this final lecture of the series, I shall recapitulate what we've been talking about over these past weeks and try to make it clear that in spite of any appearances to the contrary, there has been a certain method in the madness of wandering about over these widely diverse fields. I have tried, as I explained in the first lecture, to deal with the human situation on its large scale, on the biological and social scale, and to relate the various sets of facts which we could elicit in examining these problems with the ethical and aesthetic and even political corollaries which follow from the facts. It has been, as I say, an effort to build bridges between the data as they are given and the values which, as human beings, particularly human beings living in a democratic society, which we desire to pursue and to which we are dedicated. Well, as you may remember, I began with a discussion of man's relationship to his planet. At the time, I referred to that relationship, which is rather disastrous as we look around the world. I referred to it as a relationship between a parasite and its host. But since talking or listening to Dr. Noble, I have a great, much better opinion of parasites than I used to have. And I find that they are really, on the whole, just rather harmless creatures living in a rather peculiar kind of symbiotic relationship with their hosts, and that they've been doing so from a very, very early stage of evolution. And evidently, this is one of the built-in patterns of nature. So don't let's use this word any longer. That man has unfortunately not been living on his planet like the more beneficent kind of parasite, but he threatens to live almost like a cancer, like a growth upon the body of the earth, which menaces actually to destroy this pseudo-organism on which he's living. I brought out the facts which have been profusely documented in great deal of recent literature of the wholesale erosion which has been going on in so many parts of the world, of the frightful deforestation, the reckless abuse of soil, and the way in which, in fact, man has been living on agricultural capital in so many parts of the world, has been exhausting his soil capital without any consideration of future generations. And of course, in all too many cases, he has been absolutely forced to do this, inasmuch as only by mining the soil, only by employing what the Germans call Raubwirtschaft, a robber economy, has he been able to obtain sufficient supplies for a rapidly increasing population? Well, the trouble is that quite clearly we can't go on with this indefinitely, and that a completely new attitude will have to be taken on a worldwide scale towards this problem. And this I try to emphasize in the second lecture. I pointed out that there will have to be an extension of our present ethical views, that the whole idea, for example, of the golden rule, of the rule of do as you would be done by, must be applied not merely to human beings, but even to the animal creation, and in general, to the whole complex ecological system of the planet on which we live. If we want to be treated well by nature, we have to treat nature well. If we do not treat her well, nature will treat us extremely badly and will end by completely destroying us. So this, as I say, this extension of the golden rule down from the our neighbors in the human world to our neighbors in the subhuman world is imperatively necessary. And we have at the same time, I think, to realize that what for many centuries we have refused to realize in the West, that we are an essential part of nature. Unfortunately, the Judeo-Christian tradition in its most orthodox form drew a kind of line between man and nature, as though man were of a different order. And this, I think, has led to many very unfortunate consequences of a moral kind. I mean, you will find, as I pointed out, in orthodox ethical writings of the Middle Ages and even up to quite recent times, the idea that animals have no rights because they have no soul, and that living beings below the level of the human being may be treated as things. Well, in fact, we have no right even to treat things as things. I mean, we realize more and more that the things by which we are surrounded on the planet are actually, to a great extent, alive. The soil is actually full of life. And even when they are not fully alive, they are a kind of quasi-organism which we disturb and maltreat at our peril. That, as I say, we must not treat even things as things. We must treat them as though they were a kind of living organism of which we ourselves are a part. And I pointed out this very interesting fact that in this evolution of mankind, we seem to pass through a kind of spiral course. We pass from the totemistic stage, a very early stage of cultural evolution, into the more self-conscious stage in which a kind of sharp line is drawn between man and nature. And we have now come round to a point immediately above the totemistic stage, which is a sort of analogue to it on the scientific level. It is possible to say that a post-Darwinian view of the world is in a certain sense analogous to the totemistic view of the world, but in an entirely different intellectual context. And we have to think, it seems to me, of the world in which we live in terms of a morality which is consonant with this a new philosophy of man in his relation to nature. And it is interesting to consider too the kinds of art which have appeared in the world which express this idea. We see it, it's expressed in its most primitive form, of course, in the ancient cave paintings of animals. But in civilized societies, it has been expressed in the most exquisitely beautiful form, for example, in the landscape paintings of China and a few centuries later of Japan, and again centuries after that in Europe. This is, incidentally, is a very curious fact that landscape painting should have arisen 700 or 800 years in China before it arose in Europe. A very strange, very interesting, and rather difficult to explain phenomenon. You find these expressions. You find expressions in the literature of the Far East, in these extraordinary Japanese poems, the haiku. And in modern European literature, you find this so-called nature mysticism running through the literature of the early 19th century, above all, and through the later 19th century. The nature mysticism of Wordsworth in England, of Whitman in many of his writings in this country, which is a kind of, an artistic reminder of our true relationship with our planet, which I, for one, find extremely valuable and regret the lack of in much contemporary literature. Well, so much for the kind of ethical and correlated artistic expressions of this new relationship which we are aware of between ourselves and the world. We now come to the problem of practical politics. How do we remedy this situation in which so much of the Earth's surface is being maltreated by the human beings who live on it? Here, obviously, we're up against a very difficult problem. The problem which confronts us is simply this. How can we prevent innumerable human beings who are now desperately mining the soil because they can't get their subsistence in any other way from doing irreparable damage? How are we to prevent them pursuing short-range advantages at the long-range expense of the human race at large? And above all, how are we to prevent them doing this in a completely democratic way? It has been, for example, take a simple example, it has been said by various experts in the agricultural field in South and Central America that there are probably about 20 million people now living on dangerously eroded watersheds and deteriorated land, who, if they are permitted to go on using their present methods of agriculture, will do appalling damage to the soil, damage which maybe will take many, many centuries to repair unless this destructive procedure is stopped very quickly. Well, the problem arises, how are you going to take these 20 million people off the soil? How quickly can you teach them to employ better methods? Where are you going to put them while you build up the fertility of the damaged soil? And how are you going to do all this without using extreme dictatorial methods? The question, I think, is a really agonizing one, because it seems pretty clear that it's almost impossible to achieve many of these very desirable ends without the use of the authority of a highly centralized government, ordering people about in what to them may appear a rather arbitrary way, but unfortunately a way which, for the sake of the human race in the future, is absolutely necessary. And it may be that the practical problems involved in solving the relationship with the planet, in making that relationship a fruitful and enduring relationship, it may be that the problems involved in this will, unfortunately, prove to be soluble only by methods certainly not strictly democratic and not chosen by the vote of the people involved, the procedure being too slow and requiring too long an educational process to be possible in the rather critical state in which so much of the planet finds itself at the moment. So we find ourselves there confronted with a situation in which it seems pretty clear there will have to be a very considerable increase of centralized authority and of the use of simply of command rather than consent in handling this very difficult problem. These are regrettable facts, but I think we have to face that this is very likely true. Well, closely related to the the ecological problem, the man's relationship to his the planet on which he lives, is of course the population problem. Here again, let me quickly recapitulate the outstanding facts: the fact that the increase of population until very recent times has been exceedingly slow, that the population of the world, it took 1600 years for the population of the world to double between the time of Christ and the time of Queen Elizabeth, and that now the population shows every sign of doubling in less than half a century. And of course the numbers involved are incomparably greater, that at the time of the birth of Christ there were perhaps 250 million human beings on the entire planet. There are now 2.8 billions. And by the end of the century, the various estimates issued by the United Nations indicate that there may be anything between 5.5 to 7 billions. So that we see that there is an absolutely unprecedented situation confronting us. Well, here again, we must ask ourselves what should be our value judgments in regard to this, and what are the practical things that can be done. I feel very strongly that the sort of ethical judgments which have to be used in regard to this are judgments of the of quality versus quantity. I mean, if we wish to improve the quality of human life, the quality of individuals' achievements and creativity in the world, we probably have to reduce the enormously rapid increase which is going on now. That this qualitative improvement is seems to be incompatible with a very rapid quantitative increase. There are many reasons for this, obviously. I mean, for one thing, the extreme difficulty of increasing the food supply and supply of manufactured goods faster than the increase of population, so as to obtain an improvement in the standard of living. And secondly, as is being found now, the difficulty of creating educational facilities fast enough to catch up with the enormous population increase. As the UNESCO has pointed out recently, we have this painfully ironic fact that in spite of the enormous efforts in relation to education made since the end of the Second World War, there are now more adult illiterates in the world than there were at any previous time in history. There, over and above the 800 million children who have to be taught, there are now 700 million adults who require to be taught. And needless to say, the difficulty of creating the facilities for teaching them, the difficulty of building enough schools and of training enough teachers, is simply insuperable for people living in the underdeveloped countries with very small amounts of capital. And so that we see then that there is a real incompatibility between uncontrolled quantity and the rising quality of human life. And I think that our value judgments in regard to this must be polarized around this idea of how do we improve the quality of life, and which entails the idea of in some way limiting the enormous and catastrophic increase in quantity which is going on at the present time. The reasons for the increase, of course, are quite clear. It is due to something which in itself is very good, which is the lowering of the death rate. The birth rate has remained, of course, where it is in many, where it was in the past during in many parts of the world. whereas the death rate has fallen very sharply. And a simple example is that of Ceylon, where the elimination of malaria in the 3 years between 1945 and 1948 reduced the death rate from about 36 per thousand to about 15, whereas the birth rate remained where it was when at least 50% of the children used to die. Consequently, there is this 3% per annum increase, with a prospect of the population doubling in less than 25 years. And naturally, nobody has any idea how this the problems arising from such an enormously rapid increase are going to be solved. So that we see ourselves then confronted with what is essentially an ecological problem, the problem of balance. The old natural balances have been completely upset. And the problem confronting us, therefore, is can we re-establish the balance in an intelligent and humane way, rather than waiting until nature shall re-establish the balance in the old, inhumane way, that is to say, by famine and pestilence, which unquestionably it will do if the present situation is left unremedied. So that we have here a very clear need for a new ethical evaluation. And I think we have, above all, it seems to me, a clear need for better thinking on the subject. Unfortunately, we tend to always to oversimplify problems. We can say, I think it's quite true to say that oversimplification is the original sin of the intellect. And oversimplification is something which infects almost all political thinking and distorts almost all political action, because it is so difficult for human beings to think in terms of multiple causation. They are always tempted, particularly if they are in positions of authority, to say that a particular unpleasant situation has only one or perhaps two or three main causes, and that therefore a single panacea or one or two systems of cure will put the thing to rights. But in fact, as we find, that there are a great many causative factors involved in producing any complex human situation. And this terribly elementary point of view, which is the typical point of view of politicians and always has been, is wholly irrelevant to the problem. I mean, we talk about these problems as though the solution were a military solution or a diplomatic solution or an economic solution. But underneath all these things lies the biological problem. And when we examine this closely, this problem of bringing the death rate and the birth rate into some kind of balance, we find that this also is a complicated problem. It is both a problem in biochemistry, a problem in medicine, a problem in psychology, in sociology, of inducing people to accept new ideas, a problem even in religion. So that there is nothing simple about this problem at all. And it remains, it seems to me, I mean, one of our prime duties is to think realistically about these problems, instead of thinking as we do in an extremely unrealistic way. And to realize, again, a very, very important idea, which I think so many of us rather shrink from accepting, the idea that the consequences of intellectual sins may be just as grave as moral sins, and indeed in many cases they seem to be much graver, the actual consequences of them. For example, this intellectual sin of oversimplification may have consequences much graver than the politicians accepting graft or committing adultery or something. These fundamental intellectual sins may be of the most frightful nature from the point of view of what they can do to human beings and of what they can fail to do. So that, as I say, we here, and indeed in all these aspects of the human situation, we have to realize the moral duty of thinking as realistically as we possibly can about these very complicated problems, which have to be attacked on many fronts at once. Well, in the next lecture, I talked about another biological aspect of the human situation, which is the innate variability of human beings, the hereditary variability, that human beings do not conform to a single pattern, that the idea of the average man is purely a statistical and actuarial idea, that in fact the average man doesn't exist except as an arithmetical abstraction, that no human being that we talk to is an average man or an average woman. He is a human being who varies in either slightly or often into a very considerable extent from all other human beings. And a great deal of work has been done recently on the nature of human variability, which is greater than the variability within any other species. It's a general rule that the variability increases as we rise in the evolutionary scale. And human beings seem to be quite exceptionally variable, even in relation to their nearest relations. We find that there are, in fact, very considerable anatomical differences. The recent atlases of anatomy, for example, have to show at least 12 pictures of the human hand to show the common variations which occur in the structure of the hand, at least 8 pictures of the heart to show the variations in the heart, and so on and so forth. And at the same time, we are discovering more and more that there are quite significant biochemical differences between individuals, and it's becoming increasingly clear that probably a great deal of mental illness is correlated with anomalies in the biochemical makeup of certain individuals, and that the reason why we are not all mad, and only some of us are mad, is that only some of us have the kind of biochemical makeup which will cause us to react badly to the traumas which everybody has to go through during childhood and in the course of life. And the problem is to find out why, from the individual hereditary point of view, certain people are more liable to these mental disorders or to a general kind of weakness and liability to disease than others are. And we are probably getting fairly near the time when we shall know pretty clearly about these matters. We're on a threshold, I think, which we shall pass probably within another 10 or 20 years. But meanwhile, what are the ethical and political corollaries of the fact of human variability? I think they seem to me to be perfectly clear. They were recognized, of course, intuitively long ago in the past. The ethical corollary in the traditional religions is the Christian and indeed the Buddhist and Muslim and Hindu idea of the supreme value of the individual soul. In political terms, it is, of course, the democratic idea of the equality of individuals before the law, which are ideas of profound importance, which unfortunately have been disputed and neglected and denied in many parts of the world during the last few years by totalitarian regimes, who desire, above all, to iron out human differences, to roll people out flat, so as to have a more convenient mass material to handle for dictatorial purposes. And I think we can say that there are perfectly good biological reasons, chemical, anatomical reasons, whatever you like to say, for these basic ideas of democracy and the basic ideas of the traditional religions. And I think it is extremely important for us to give these, to realize that these basic ideas have a perfectly good scientific foundation, and to make ourselves aware of the scientific foundations of our beliefs. And then we have to, from the ethical points of view which are developed from these ideas, are of course the idea that every human being has a right to be physically and temperamentally what he is born to be, and that consequently tolerance is a great good and persecution is a great evil. And another very important ethical and political corollary which rises from the recognition of the fact of human variability is that it is necessary to raise the environment for everybody to its highest possible pitch, for it is only when every individual enjoys the optimum nutritional and educational opportunities that his native abilities and idiosyncrasies can be developed to the limit. If the environment is bad, many of the desirable variations within human beings will be masked and suppressed and overlaid by the effects of a bad environment. So that we see again that the bridge between facts and values in this this realm, this biological realm of heredity, leads us to the view that the most desirable state is a welfare state in which the best possible is done for all individuals, and that only so can we hope to get the fullest advantage out of this extraordinary effect of human variability. And this, I think, is again is something very important to remember. Over and against this fact of great individual variability, we must place what is the most important effect in the development of societies in modern times. This is the fact of what I may call the technical revolution. We all, of course, were brought up in our history books on the Industrial Revolution, the idea of the Industrial Revolution. But actually, the phrase Industrial Revolution is much too narrow. The whole point of what has happened, it seems to me, in modern times, is not that there has been a change in the methods of production and manufacture, but that there has been a technical revolution in every aspect of human life. Now, we have to define the idea of technique. And I suppose the best definition is something of this kind, that the technique, in our sense of the word, is the solution of any given problem by perfectly clear-cut rational ideas. The idea is that using these rational and clear-cut ideas, we shall solve the problem in the most efficient way possible, in the most rapid way possible. And consequently, there has come in the last 200 years or so to be a new attitude towards efficiency. We can almost say that the efficiency has become almost the main categorical imperative of modern times, and that this categorical imperative has overridden many of the old categorical imperatives of the old traditional religion and morality, that a thing has to be efficient, and if many old human values have to go by the board in order to achieve efficiency, then they have to go by the board. And it's interesting to compare our present ideas of technique and organization with the ideas and practices which prevailed in the past. In relation to means of production, technique, as I pointed out, used to be a technique comparable to what we call technique in the virtuoso, in the piano virtuoso, or the violin virtuoso, or the singing virtuoso. It was a method of getting the individual human being to use his talents to the very limit, and where he had actually to make use of instruments to produce his result, to get the most perfect results by the extremely skillful use of extremely simple instruments. And this, of course, was the whole essence of the old apprenticeship system, that you had to go through your 7 years of apprenticeship learning this extraordinary skill of hand, at the end of which you passed an examination, you made what was called a masterpiece, and if it was considered worthy by the existing masters, then you yourself became a master, which meant to say that you had developed a skill of hand, a knack, which permitted you to achieve extraordinary feats of perfection with extremely rudimentary tools. And of course, as one looks back over the history of human artifacts, one is quite amazed by the beauty and immense efficiency and perfect craftsmanship of objects and implements made by human beings using tools no more elaborate than bits of stone, or else crude chisels made of bronze or iron. It is, of course, perfectly extraordinary what can be done by human beings if they learn this knack. When we come to modern times, we find that the whole ideal is completely different. We do not wish to rely on the sort of virtuoso abilities of individuals. The whole aim has been to create extremely complicated instruments which shall be foolproof, which shall work in spite of the ineptitude of the people who work them. The whole idea has been to bypass human talent, intuition, insight, and to create gadgets which shall turn out standardized and perfectly formed objects, simply because of the machines are so well contrived. And in this sense, the idea of technique in production has changed profoundly in the last century or so. And similarly, there's been, in the application of technique to the other activities of human beings, there has been a steady attempt to set up organizations so perfect, so machine-like in their precision, that the ideal is that it shall become almost unnecessary for there to be a display of human talent and insight and spontaneity. The idea is to create organizations in which the rational thinking shall have been done in advance in the creation of the organization, so that it will be unnecessary for people to use much talent in working the organizations afterwards. Naturally, the talent is still necessary in our organizations, but one can see that the logical conclusion is an organization working by means of electronic machines and so on, where the absolute minimum of human talent and spontaneity will be necessary. And this, I do think, is an extremely grave fact, because it seems to bypass many of the things which we feel to be most valuable in human beings, and to be in process of setting up a kind of non-human world of mechanical and organizational perfection, which neglects many of the aspects of human life which we have thought to be valuable up till now. And it should be noted, as I pointed out, that the prime difference between the Western world and the communist world is a difference in the willingness to apply technique to all human activities. Both Marx and Engels, especially Engels, were enthusiastic for technique, and their whole view was taken up by Lenin and has remained central in the whole communist theory. And they are ready to apply technique to fulfill the categorical imperative of efficiency. They are ready to apply it without any inhibitions at all. And this, of course, is the reason why, to our great surprise and chagrin, the Russians have made very startling advances within the last 15 or 20 years. In the Western countries, we are ready to apply technique in all fields which don't directly impinge upon our traditional religious and democratic views. But in these latter fields, we are reluctant to apply it. We would like to preserve the old values. But unfortunately, we often find ourselves in a world which is dominated by nationalist rivalries and the Cold War. We find ourselves compelled to sacrifice the old values to the new categorical imperative of efficiency through technique which bypasses human spontaneity and traditional activities, which were traditional and remained in force simply because they were emotionally satisfying, not because they were efficient. And what is the way out of this problem? I think this is a very difficult thing. It's quite clear that there is this whole application of technique to more and more human activities, from material production at one end to mind manipulation at the other, is an immense impersonal force which is pushing us ineluctably, perhaps, towards a state of things, a totalitarian central control and perhaps finally very non-human kind of society. We have to ask ourselves, what are we to do to try to remedy this state of things? Because this force is there pushing us. And I suppose, to start with, I think one of the things quite clearly we have to do is to try to develop a world of personal freedom within the world of inhuman and totalitarian technology. I think this will be one of the problems confronting us as automation increases our time of leisure. We shall find it more and more necessary to find methods for using that leisure to preserve our fully human powers, to preserve our to foster our creativity and our spontaneity, increase the penetration of our insight. We will have to find activities and ways of thought and feeling which will do all this, so that we may be like Epictetus, who was a slave and yet was able to preserve his personal freedom within a system which socially condemned him to a subhuman existence. And as I say, I think this will be a very important factor in the years to come. And then, on the other hand, it seems to me that it's not beyond the wit of man to provide organizations which shall be efficient and yet flexible, to provide means of decentralized democratic control on a small scale, which will in some way offset the almost necessary increase of central authority. And also, I think undoubtedly what would help us in this situation is any kind of policy which would reduce the tension between the warring nations, the competing nations in the modern world, that there would then cease to be this terribly urgent necessity for forcing a dehumanizing technique more and more upon society. If we could, this would happen if we could reduce the pressure of the Cold War. And this brings us, of course, now to this, what is our most painfully close and immediate problem, the problem of war and nationalism. The closeness with which nationalism is related to war was well illustrated when the old League of Nations was founded, and it was found that the only satisfactory definition of a nation was a society with military forces, which indicates how very intimately the whole idea of a nation and of war are linked. The only, to my mind, the only consoling factor in the present situation is that both war and nationalism are essentially arbitrary ideas. They are not built-in instinctive ideas. Both are connected, of course, with built-in instinctive ideas. War is connected with general combativity, shall we say, but it is not a necessary part of combativity. If we look over the biological record, we shall find that war is excessively rare, that it exists only in certain species of ants and in human beings and in no other animal species, that there are no other animal species which organize attacks upon members of their own species. Most of them, evolution has been taken extreme pains to see that they don't do this. So we see then that this idea of war is not a biologically built-in thing. It is a sociological and cultural product. And the same thing, I think, is true with regard to nationalism. This is connected with something which is, so to speak, built-in, which is a kind of local, familial, tribal patriotism, a feeling of solidarity with the places and the people immediately surrounding us. But the modern nation, of course, is an immense abstraction in regard to any given individual. He is not in any personal touch with the nation as a whole, as he was in touch even in the Greeks, with the Greek city-state, with a state of, say, 50,000 people. He was in real touch with all his fellows. But this is no longer true of a nation of 50 or 100 or 200 million. We are not in touch. We are in touch only with a symbolic picture of this thing, an abstraction, and the idea of this abstraction and the patriotism in relation to the abstraction has to be very carefully indoctrinated in childhood. And the fact that these two plagues of modern life, nationalism and war, are arbitrary things and not intrinsic, built-in, instinctive things, as I say, gives us some measure of hope. It shows that if one set of arbitrary concepts is built up, it can be replaced by another set without too much difficulty. But meanwhile, of course, we have to remember that nationalism remains the religion of the 20th century. It is the only religion, an idolatrous religion, incidentally, a religion which absolutizes a part as though it were God. It is the only religion for which men will now kill and die in any large numbers. We see that in the newly independent countries, it is a religion of a fanatical intensity. And we are confronted, therefore, with this very uncomfortable fact that here we have something which is has the intensity, say, of Mohammedanism in the first century after Muhammad. So that how we are to deal with this is a very difficult problem. How we can create some kind of international feeling, how we can replace the idea of loyalty to this abstract nation with the idea of loyalty to another abstraction, which is humanity at large. This is a grave psychological and educational problem. And I myself feel that there is not much prospect of doing this unless we can do two things. First of all, unless we can get rid of preparation for war as the chief support of our economy, which it is at the present time, so that there is an immense vested interest in preserving these preparations, which are themselves a major cause of conflict, of possible conflict. And in the second place, it seems to me very unlikely that we shall get out of this frightful dilemma of war and nationalism unless we can somehow, in international conferences, change the focus of attention, to move it away from the insoluble problems of militarism and nationalism towards the perhaps soluble problems of how to provide a better life for the two-thirds of the human race who are at present living in intolerable and subhuman conditions. And it's quite clear that the doing something for this unfortunate two-thirds of the human race is going to be one of the areas in which the Cold War is going to be waged over the next few years. If we escape the hot war, there will be this competition as to who can do most for these unfortunate people will be, I think, the major field in which the two power blocks will operate. And my hope is that when this comes to pass, perhaps more and more attention will be paid to this essentially human problem than to the utterly inhuman and utterly insoluble problems of military power. Then in my last lecture, I talked about the future, which is potentially, obviously, quite extraordinary. There is no doubt that if we succeed in avoiding war, and if we succeed in solving the problems of overpopulation and over-organization, that we can do quite amazing things. We have the potentialities of raising human efficiency, personal efficiency, of realizing human potentialities, of getting rid of many forms of mental and physical disease. The huge prospects open up before us. And the great point that confronts us is simply this, that we have a choice in front of us, that we, if we are sufficiently skillful and have sufficient goodwill, we can realize these potentialities. But if we act too slowly or act stupidly or act malevolently, we shall certainly not, that we shall plunge into a condition of increasing inhumanity or even perhaps go down in some hideous kind of destruction. So that, as I say, the future is in our hands. I think that the people like Harrison Brown, who speak of the next 50 or 100 years being the most critical period in human history, are probably perfectly right, that we are confronted by opportunities such as no generation has ever had before, but also by dangers such as no generation has ever faced before. And it is facing this supreme dilemma that I propose to close this series, this half of the series. In the second half of the series, which I shall be beginning in the autumn semester, I shall talk about the human situation on the personal level, discuss such questions of who are we, what is our nature, what the nature of creativity, the nature of art, the nature of man in relation to his symbols and to his social arrangements. I shall talk about the possibility of realizing the latent potentialities of man, which we to such a large extent fail to realize now. As I say, the method in the madness has been that there's been this first series has dealt with a man on the large scale, so to speak, the macrocosm of human life. And in this second series, I shall try to say something about the microcosm, the private life of emotional, creative life of man, which there's, of course, an infinite amount to say about this, but I hope to be able to cram into a few lectures, anyhow, a few of the more important aspects of this immensely significant field. Thank you.